This interview with Dr. Lindsay Fletcher about the sun is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to jodcast.net.
What are solar flares?
Solar flares are massive periods of energy release in the solar atmosphere. People sometimes think of it like an explosion, but it's not really an explosion, because an explosion is driven by gas pressure. And in the solar atmosphere, gas pressure is not important. What's important is magnetic pressure. It's the energy density, if you like, of the magnetic field. And in a solar flare, what is happening is that energy, which was previously stored in the magnetic field of the solar corona, is released in a very dramatic way. You can now go into two directions. You can think about, well, how was that energy stored in the magnetic field, which is in itself a very interesting field of endeavour. Lots of people in the UK and around the world study this. Or you can say, well, what happens when that energy is released? And I really follow that second part. What happens when that energy is released?
Before you go on, let's think, when we talk about the solar atmosphere, I mean, the sun is a big ball of gas.
Yeah.
Isn't it all atmosphere? I mean, when we talk about the solar atmosphere, what are we talking about?
Yeah, you're right. Well, we do think about the sun as having a surface, okay? Solar astronomers talk about a surface, but this is not a solid surface. This is not a surface you could stand on, apart from the fact it's very hot. But it's not a surface you could stand on. It's defined by, if you like, the last surface that light can escape from. It's defined by what we call the optical depth to radiation of a particular wavelength. And basically the fact that the sun has this surface called a photosphere tells you that the density of the gas, which is scattering and emitting the light, changes very rapidly at that point. And so in terms of there being a change in density, then there is something which we could think of as a surface, like the surface between, you know, the Earth and the Earth's atmosphere. You could look at that as just a change in density. It goes from water to air, for example. And so you can think of an analogous thing in the sun. So there's this thing we call the solar surface, or the photosphere, the sphere of light. And above that, it becomes hotter, mysteriously. It becomes less dense, more tenuous. It becomes strongly ionized, which is to say that the atoms have had electrons stripped away from them, so that the gas is electrically charged, if you like, and it can carry a current, which is also very important in understanding its magnetic structure, it turns out. And that's the region that we call, well, depending on its height above the photosphere, we call it the chromosphere, and then above that still the corona. And that together, the chromosphere and the corona, is what we would call the atmosphere of the sun.
Right, this region just above that surface of last scattering.
Yes, I guess that's what
basically when the little photons become free, so to speak.
Yes. Not every wavelength is free. Some wavelengths will still be absorbed in the solar corona's radio wavelengths, some, you know, just depending. But basically from the solar corona we see what's called extreme ultraviolet or X-ray emission. That's very high energy emission. And the fact we see that tells us that the corona is very hot. It sets the temperature at about, you know, somewhere between 1 and 4 million degrees centigrade. Kelvin, really, but, you know, it's more or less the same when you get to that temperature. And this was a puzzle in 1937, I think. The green line corona was observed, and this is making spectroscopic spectral line observations of the corona. This particular spectral line, green in colour, was observed, and it couldn't be identified for a long time. A couple of scientists, whose names escape me, worked out that the only feasible thing could be the emission from the element iron, but in a very highly ionised state with lots and lots of electrons stripped away, which tells you that the gas is very energetic or very hot. And it was basically at that point that it was realised that the corona was at millions of degrees Kelvin compared to the photosphere, which is at a mere 6,000 degrees Kelvin. And nobody really understood that. And to be honest, we know roughly why. We know roughly why the corona is heated, but we still don't understand, you know, 70 years later, we still don't really understand why the corona is heated. So the corona is hot, it's emitting an X-rays and ultraviolet radiation. Also, if you've ever been privileged enough to see a solar eclipse, which I never have, sadly, if you've been privileged to see a solar eclipse, then you know that you see this wonderful streamer crown-like structure around the sun. You can, and you can see that with your eyes suitably shielded unless you're in absolute totality. And that's optical radiation, white light radiation, and that comes from photons which have been emitted from the surface of the sun and then scattered by the free electrons in the corona, mm-hmm. because it's ionised. Mm-hmm. There's electrons scattered into the line of sight in a process called Thomson scattering. And so basically these are the radiation types that you see. There's also radio, of course. I should mention radio, being at Jodrell. Yes. Lots and lots of radio emission from the solar corona, covering all wavelengths. Yes, very important diagnostic for the corona is radio. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, not too many people study solar radio astronomy compared to other branches of solar astronomy. I think it's not sexy enough or something. I don't really know.
Well, the higher energy wavelengths are where we learn a lot about the high energy physics.
They are indeed, and that brings us actually back to flares, because the flares, these releases of magnetic energy, they do, you know, a large number of things to the solar atmosphere. The first thing they do is cause, you might call it, bulk motions, expulsions of clouds of plasma in a process called a coronal mass ejection. On average, about a billion tons of ionised material moving through space, on average about a million miles per hour.
These are chunks of the sun, isn't it?
This is bits of the solar atmosphere, plus its entrained magnetic field.
Ooh.
So, yes, plasmoids is the name sometimes they call it.
Technoplasmoids, yes.
So coronal mass ejections are one part of the whole event that we call the flare, I suppose. If this magnetised plasma reaches our planet, then it interacts with our Earth's own magnetic field, it squashes it, distorts it, it pumps our magnetosphere, the Earth's magnetosphere, with energy. And, you know, that has consequences for satellites, which can get, you know, disturbed by the ionosphere being heated, and disturbs the Earth's magnetic field and accelerates electrons, etc., etc. So this is very important to understand the mass ejection and how it impacts the Earth. Now, that's one side of the sort of whole flare process. What I actually look at is processes happening much closer into the sun. Mm-hmm. And the other major effect of solar flares is accelerating electrons and ions up to very high speeds. In some cases, up to close to the speed of light. And the sun seems to do this with startling efficiency. It seems that something like half of the energy which is available in the magnetic field, we can calculate this, roughly half of that is converted into the kinetic energy, the energy of motion of these fast particles, which are accelerated seemingly in, you know, fractions of a second up to these huge energies. And so I guess what I'm interested in is, why does this happen? How mm-hmm. do these particles get accelerated? How can we use the radiation that we see from flares to understand about the particles, and then one step further back to understand about the accelerator?
It's a remarkably efficient process, isn't it? 50%. I mean, yeah. When you talk about efficiency in everyday things like car engines and machines that we can build in terms of efficiency, 50% is very, very high.
It is. And it's really a bit of a mystery. I mean, I should say that this number, 50%, it is conditional on some what we would call model assumptions. Of course, we can't go to the sun and we can't actually directly, you know, stick a particle counter in there and count how many particles there are and how fast they're going. We can't do that. So we arrive at these numbers by looking at the radiation that they produce and developing a, if you like, a physical model, which eventually becomes a mathematical model for how the radiation is produced. And one of the parameters in that model, one of the things that we can vary to understand the model, is the acceleration efficiency. Basically, the amount of energy going into the electrons and the number of electrons that there are. And so it must be realised that there's different, you know, scientists, solar physicists have got different ideas about how the radiation might be made.
When you talk about radiation, you're talking about electromagnetic radiation.
I'm talking here about electromagnetic radiation, primarily X-rays, again, what we call hard X-rays. X-rays, very high energy X-rays, almost gamma rays, in fact. But also radio, again. Radio is so lovely, yet so difficult in the case of the sun. It's a complicated plasma physics process.
So we observe the radiation that's emitted during these events, and then we infer what's going on
exactly
in the sun itself.
Yes.
So that makes us our model.
Yes.
And we try and figure out what's going on.
Yes. So as you say, the inferences from this process are that it's a tremendously efficient particle accelerator. And, of course, you know, we're interested, I'm interested in it in its own right. I want to know what's happening. Well, first of all, the only thing that can accelerate charged particles is efficiently is an electric field. You need an electric field. Somehow, the corona of the sun, and maybe by implication, coronae of other stars and also other magnetised plasmas in the universe, are very good at making electric fields. Mm-hmm. Electric fields which efficiently accelerate particles. So although I'm interested in specifically in the solar corona, it's maybe reasonable to consider the processes in the corona as being a bit of a touchstone for understanding more distant objects. Mm-hmm. And one of the nice things actually about the corona is that although we can't go there, hopefully within the next 10 years or so we'll be able to go quite close to there. There's a project on the cards right now called the Solar Orbiter, which is an ESA-NASA project now, which should approach, not very close to the sun. I'm trying to think how far away. Something like 0.25 of an astronomical unit, being the distance between the Earth and the sun. And when it reaches this distance, it's flying around the sun, it's orbiting the sun and flying through the sun's magnetic field at that distance, and also able to sample the particles and observe what's happening in the surface. So, in the next 10 years, we should be able to, if not go right into the corona, which we certainly can't do, at least see what's coming out of it in the sense of counting the particles and measuring the field. So
that's going to be very exciting.
Oh, it will be tremendous. It will be tremendous.
When does this fly?
Well, this is a mission which is at the stage right now of sort of proposal stage. I mean, it's somewhat more advanced than proposal stage, in the instrument building teams have submitted their proposals to fly on the mission. So it's in the ESA program, but until the money's on the table and they're actually starting to build bits, you can never say for certain. But the estimated hope for launch date is 2015, maybe 2017 being a possibility as
well. It must be a remarkably hard technological project, because even at Earth orbit, the sun has a remarkable effect on satellites, as you mentioned, but sending something purposely towards the sun and expecting it to survive must be very difficult.
Yes, there are several severe technological challenges, which is probably one of the reasons that ESA is interested in it.
Right.
You have to deal with the fact that you are you're four times closer in, so there's 16 times the radiation flux, basically. Mm. And so just the heat load on this spacecraft will be huge. So there's technology development there necessary to build heat shields.
Yep.
There's a higher particle radiation flux from the sun. I mean, there's going to be, for example, a lot more neutrons. Neutrons are very interesting because on their way from the sun, most neutrons decay before they get to the Earth. They have a half-life of 888 seconds, I think,
minutes,
in their rest frame. Mm. And so that's approaching the time actually takes for them to free stream from the sun to the Earth. And so by the time they get to the Earth, or at the distance of the Earth, rather, there's not many neutrons left. But as you go closer and closer to the sun, you really see a lot more neutrons, not just because of the inverse square law, but also because there's not so many have decayed. So there's a higher neutron environment, there's a higher particle environment, higher radiation environment. And all these things have to be studied. So it's a long timescale mission, as well as the aspects of the propulsion that you need. People were talking a few years ago about building ion engines to make this feasible. Now, mm-hmm. that turns out not to be feasible for technical reasons, which I have no idea of, and so it's just back to normal chemical propulsion. But before, this was going to be a sort of technology mission that would test solar electric propulsion, ion engines, all kinds of stuff like that.
But they tried that with Deep Space One, and I guess it's pretty good for sending things away from the sun, to long projectile orbits. But I guess if you're sending something close to the sun, you want to be able to control it quickly and now, I guess.
Well, I don't know what the technological holdups were, to be quite honest. One of the big problems about sending something close to the sun is that there comes a point where you can't communicate with it anymore. Not because it's too far away, but because it enters the extended corona of the sun, and radio frequencies are cut off. You encounter actually a radio cut off, and then the spacecraft is going behind the sun. It's orbiting the sun, so for some of the time, it is behind the sun, and so you can't communicate with it at all, and so it has to have an essentially autonomous program that will operate in a very different way from almost every other telescope or satellite that we've used, with the exception, for example, of, you know, Mars rovers, where you've got a communication lag and you've got to, they've got to have a certain amount of autonomy to be able to get around and look at stuff. But Solar Orbiter, you know, we're going to have to program in observing campaigns of a few weeks that the satellite will carry out by itself on the other side of the sun, and then you know, when it's back in contact, we'll just download all the data. So it's quite a challenge.
So for a couple of weeks, there's a whole bunch of very nervous mission scientists wondering if the satellite's going to
wondering whether the satellite's going to come out the other side. I can't imagine. So. You know, so that's something for the future, certainly. But and hopefully that kind of study will help us, you know, unlock the secrets of the particle acceleration and the solar atmosphere.
What more will this new mission tell us that a mission like SOHO hasn't told us? I mean, SOHO has given us these fantastic images of coronal mass ejections and all sorts of things.
SOHO has been quite amazing. But what Solar Orbiter has is, well, a couple of things. It has an orbit which, after some time, I can't remember exactly, you know, the order of a year or so, it will be cranked up out of the ecliptic plane, out of the plane of the solar system, so that its view will, it will start looking down on the surface of the sun at different angles. It will never be looking down right on the pole of the sun, but it will have a view which will give it a much better, will give scientists a much better perspective on the north and the south poles of the sun. We'll be having out of ecliptic view. It, well, this has never been done before. We've never looked at the pole of the sun. We don't know what's on the top. We
don't. That's a good point.
We don't know what's at the top of the sun. We only know its face, that, you know, the face that it presents us all the time. Of course, it rotates, but we've never been and looked at the top. And this is very important because the well, for two reasons. The first of all, the north and the south poles of the sun, these are magnetic poles of the sun, and there is what we call the open field. Now, this is a lazy, lazy term, because there is no such thing, boys and girls, as open magnetic field. All magnetic field is closed. That's the same thing as saying that div B equals zero in Maxwell's equations terms. But we talk lazily about open field as being magnetic field produced by the sun, which extends to interplanetary space and closes, we don't know where,
right,
probably at the heliopause. The outer, you know, the outer plasma bubble of the solar system.
So this is like drawing the little field lines around a bar map.
Exactly.
You connect them up always. You always start to connect them up, but right at the top, you could conceive of a little line that goes, you know, straight up and straight down.
You know, and in the case of the sun's magnetic field is pulled away from it. It's not exactly analogous to a bar magnet, which is, you know, sitting there in a non-conducting gas, and but in the sun, you know, the magnetic field is being pulled away from it by this constant outflow of material, either in what's called the solar wind or in coronal mass ejections, and that stretches the magnetic field out and distorts it and extends it to the you know, to the magnetopause, where it hits interstellar space, basically. We reach the edge of our stellar system, our solar system. And so when we look at the poles, we're looking at these so-called open field regions, and interesting things happen on the open field regions. The solar wind is accelerated in the open field regions to much higher speeds than on the rest of the sun. It reaches speeds of 800 kilometres per second or so, and we don't know why that is. We don't know why the gas is accelerated. It seems that protons and different ions and electrons are accelerated in different ways. It's just a bit of a mystery. So we want to go and have a look and see whether we can see, you know, any clues as to why the acceleration leads to such high speeds in those regions. But the other thing is that the sun, you may have heard of the solar magnetic cycle, the sunspot cycle.
Yep.
And that is, observationally, if you count the number of sunspots and make a kind of graph through time, then you see that this number of sunspots rises and then it falls again. And that process takes about 11 years. And then it starts again, another 11-year cycle. The whole process is a 22-year cycle, during which time the northward-pointing magnetic field of the sun... No, let's put it another way. If you look at the upwards direction from the sun, then at one phase in the cycle, the magnetic field is pointing upwards, is pointing northwards, and then after a complete solar cycle, it's pointing southwards, and then after another solar cycle, it's pointing northwards again. So it's like the magnetic field of the Earth, we talk about the north and the south poles of the Earth, and those directions are reversing, but on a time scale of, I think it's about 100,000 years.
Geological time, yeah.
But in the Sun, it's more like 11 years. And we don't understand how that reversal happens. But processes occurring at the pole are critical to this. At the pole, the magnetic flux from the magnetic field from the previous cycle, there's still remnants of it there. And magnetic flux from the new cycle kind of migrates up there and interacts with this old cycle flux, and somehow this is intrinsic to the process of the Sun's magnetic field reversing, and the overall process being called the solar dynamo. So in fact, by looking out of the ecliptic, looking down on the pole, we'll probably be able to fill in that last, that part of the puzzle in the solar dynamo, which is how the Sun generates its magnetic field and why the magnetic field reverses every 11 years. And you know, and part of that whole understanding is things like why are there sunspots as well. So, in fact, by looking at the pole, you can probably get quite a good understanding of a lot of different aspects of magnetic activity.
So we're going to learn a lot by looking at this.
Yes, we are.
Unknown region of the Sun.
We are. The other thing which Orbiter is going to do is essentially hover above one region of the Sun for a full rotation. Now, if you think about observing the Sun from Earth or from Soho, from anywhere else, the Sun's rotating, and so you decide you're going to look at this sunspot region, for example, and so you know it appears, okay, and you go, oh, there's a sunspot region, and normally you only see it maybe 2 or 3 days after it's actually rotated onto the disk. And so you track it across the surface of the Sun. You point your telescope so that it's moving to different, you know, parts of the solar surface, and then it's away again. You know, then it's, yeah. And so you maybe only get something like a week's worth of good observations in the life of an active region, which is unfortunate because, as far as we understand, an active region lives a lot longer than that, and so you generally can't track. When I say an active region, I mean a sunspot region and all the magnetic field that surrounds it. You can't understand the whole process of how does magnetic field bubble up from the interior of the Sun, how does it evolve under the various stresses imparted to it by, you know, surroundings and interior, you know, how does it grow and live and then die and decay. Right now we can't do that because we only efficiently see, I mean, in principle, the solar rotation period is 28 days, so if you could see half of that, then you would have 14 days. But in practice, you know, a few days at either end are cut off because they become foreshortened, is the term. And in fact, when you're trying to look at magnetic field, it becomes even more difficult. You just can't use those data. So you've got, you know, a few days in the life of an active region, and with Solar Orbiter, it will actually co-rotate with an active region, so we'll be able to study the whole birth, evolution and death of one of these magnetic regions. So it's going to do that for us as well.
It's really good. It's going to be a busy little satellite.
Yes, but its main goal is really to try and understand the linkages between the Sun, the Sun's magnetic field, and the particles which are accelerated in and onto that magnetic field. The linkages between that and interplanetary space. So what we measure in interplanetary space, what we measure on the surface of Mars, what we measure at Earth, you know, what we measure is magnetic field and particles which are generated by the Sun. And so Solar Orbiter really wants to try and make the link between, if you like, the what we call the in-situ observations at the Earth, particles and magnetic field that you can measure, you know, in the general Earth's environment or in a planetary environment, and what you can see happening in a remote sensing way on the surface of the Sun. And Solar Orbiter sits somewhere in between those two, and both images the surface of the Sun in a remote sensing way, but also samples in situ the magnetic fields and the particles, and then that can be linked back to what we see on the surfaces of other planets and the Earth. So it's to try and get a kind of holistic view, if you like, of the electromagnetic environment of the Sun, and how, and from that you can learn more about how it impacts planets and just the space environment in general.
A lot of the activity in the Sun is driven by fields, either magnetic or electric fields. what's our best understanding of how these fields are generated? Now, the magnetic field, we understand, they accelerate the particles towards us, since we see this is solar wind. And you also mentioned that the way that we get massive solar flares is through an electric field. How, let's start off with an electric field. How can we possibly get an electric field generated in the sun so that it produces these mass ejections?
Okay, difficult question. There are these equations, which we all learn at university, called Maxwell's equations. And there's a set of four very elegant equations, which describe the relationship between electric field, magnetic field, charge and current. Magnetic fields tell charged particles how to move. Electrons and ions, electrons and protons, stick to the magnetic field. They orbit around the magnetic field under the action of a force called the Lorentz force. And this means that if you move a magnetic field, the electrons and ions will follow. Conversely, if you move a bunch of electrons and ions, the magnetic field will follow. The sun is nothing but a bunch of electrons and ions, really. And so the outer part of the sun, I'm not talking about the corona here, I'm talking about the photosphere and what's below that, is in constant motion. It's rotating, because the sun's rotating. It's also boiling in this process called convection. And as the gas, the plasma, rotates and convects, it drags the magnetic field around with it. And that magnetic field is permeating the whole outer part of the solar interior and also popping up into the corona. And it's being dragged about by these massive forces under the surface, which we can't see. You know, we're working out how to map them using this technique called heliosismology, but we can't really see. But what we can see is the magnetic field pops up into the corona, and it's being pulled around by subsurface forces. And so it's being pulled around and energy is being loaded into it, and electric fields are being generated in that way. So conceptually, you can see, you know, with a bit of a physics degree, a bit of a physics education, you can understand that a changing magnetic field creates an electric field. But the problem in solar flares is, why does that electric field pop into existence so suddenly, so that it accelerates particles? Why is it not there all the time? Why is it so strong? Why? You know, there's all these different questions about the electric field. It's another, actually, a bit of a mystery. Plasma is a very highly conducting medium, and so the electrons are free to run around in this plasma. And that means you would think that any electric field that you generate is immediately just going to disappears. Be neutralised. Mm. It disappears. But apparently not. This is an interesting analogy, and in fact it's something I'm very interested in right now myself, an interesting analogy with the magnetosphere of the Earth, with the generation of the aurora, the northern lights and the southern lights. On the Earth you can fly through the regions where the aurora are being created. The light that you see is generated by atoms of nitrogen and oxygen, which have been hit by, guess what, accelerated electrons, okay? And so the atoms get hit by these fast electrons and they de-excite, and you see the lines. But the question is then, what accelerates the electrons? It's the same kind of question in a solar flare. But in the case of the aurora, you can fly through the auroral zones and you can measure the magnetic field, the electric field, and the particles, the distributions of the particles. And what you see in the aurora is that the magnetospheric plasma, or the ionospheric plasma, can sustain an electric field. Despite the fact it's very highly charged, it can sustain an electric field, which is the very electric field that accelerates electrons that you see. So right now what I'm particularly interested in is actually analogies between the auroral acceleration and solar flare acceleration. And this is, I think, actually quite a new... People have been tossing this idea around for a while, but I'm working on some.
It's a useful analogy. I mean, you can actually go measure.
I think I could. In the case of the magnetosphere, you can go and measure it. And from understanding those processes in the magnetosphere, which is now reasonably well understood, the processes in the magnetosphere. Probably a magnetospheric physicist wouldn't agree. But when I read the papers, I find an astonishing degree of consensus. So they're reasonably well understood in the magnetosphere, and so how do the same kinds of physics ideas applied work in the solar atmosphere? So that's one of the things I'm very interested in just now. So, you know, it's a nice kind of chain there. By looking locally, the magnetosphere, you can learn something about the solar atmosphere. And then maybe if you learn something about the solar atmosphere, then you learn something about stars and maybe about more exotic objects as well, like neutron star atmospheres or magnetospheres, that kind of thing. I mean, it's all everything that motivates. What motivates everything I do is wanting to understand magnetised plasmas, really. And they exist in the laboratory, and they exist throughout the universe. So, it's kind of generalist approach in that respect.
Connecting theme. Yeah. Well, thank you very, very much indeed for talking to us today. It's exciting and fascinating research, and we look forward to hearing some of the answers to those questions you posed before. So thank you very much again.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. Mm-hmm.